You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Marcus Mueller from Berlin. Marcus, thanks so much for being with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Marcus, I know there's a few projects I think we're going to talk about today. Maybe we should start with what your involvement is and what you're doing for the pavilion of the Venice Biennial of Germany.
Well, I have the pleasure of being invited by the German curator, Susanne Pfeffer, who is the director of the Friedrichianum in Kassel, where Documenta takes place. And she just announced the artist she's going to work with for next year, Anne Imhoff. They're in the middle of the works. They're planning of what to do over the long course of the Venice Biennial. It's 7+ months. And I'm very excited because I'm a big fan of Anne Imhoff's work, and I'm an even bigger fan of Susanne Pfeffer's work. And as I've been working for Venice in different ways, I was asked to advise them. And I'm very happy to do so, to give some of my background information and help them to realize what they want to realize there.
And what will that be exactly? Your background information will help them curate it, put it together. Is it designing the exhibit? How will your input actually affect what's happening?
That's a very good question. Basically, I'm an open partner for brainstorming about different kinds of things, beginning questions that have to do with how to raise money for the event, because when you go to Venice, it's always very expensive and you never have enough money. So I'll try to make useful links for Susanne to meet with people who might be able to help her out. And I'm also advising her on how to publicize the project and the event. And there's not really that much to talk about in terms of content right now, because Susanne and Anna spend quite some time already since April this year on thinking about what to do. But they haven't really decided yet. Anne is, I would say, one of the foremost young German artists out there today, working pretty internationally. And she does what I would call a performance-based art that throws a rather harsh light on the, let's call it the post-factual, post-internet reality we all live in right now. And she just had a piece at the Hamburger Bahnhof in Berlin that also then traveled in its third act to, I believe, Montreal, Isle of Montreal or to Toronto. Sorry, I don't have these facts correct right now. Mm. And we're in the midst of preparing next year's contribution.
That's exciting. So just to talk briefly for those that don't know her, what was the project that she did in Canada? Can you talk briefly about it so we just get a little insight into a little bit what you mean by this post-factual, post-internet world that we're in, that she's a critique of?
Yeah, I mean, she basically stages, I would call them situations, in which a number of people she consistently performs with have specific roles, and she designs an environment that's filled with music that she herself composes, that's filled with props, filled with lighting, filled with fog, filled in this case with falcons, live falcons that she used. The, let's call them actors or participants in her project, then, move in the space, activate it, do things that, most of us experience in their day-to-day lives, as in, taking selfies or recording performances, thus making the very recording of a performance with a handheld device, aka a cell phone, almost more important than actually looking at the real event. And that's something that she's been doing in these, I would call them almost like mini operas, for quite some time now. She studied in Frankfurt at the Städelschule, and she just finished.
So in Venice, it will be something similar. It'll be a situation.
It will
most
be. Quite honestly, we don't know yet because she's still planning on that. She's still working on that, but most likely it will, of course, follow the trajectory of her work as we know it now. Yeah,
that's exciting. That sounds like an exciting project to brainstorm about. And so let's also talk about what you're curating now, because I know you're in the midst of curating a number of things, aren't you?
Yes. Right now, I'm working on a series of events at the Haus der Kunst in Munich, and they all run under the headline Improvise Now. And up to now, we gathered a couple of concerts where we brought a sound system, the famous Killer sound system that originates from Osaka and was built in Jamaica and in Miami. Had a couple of fantastic performers spin records on that sound system.
Tell me a little bit about the Killer sound system. What is that exactly? What does that mean?
The Killer sound system is a sound system that was designed by Osaka sound system crew. They went to Jamaica, stayed there actually for a couple of years, and were the first people who were able to export original Jamaican sound system technology. And they set this up in Osaka, and then like 10, 15 years ago, they brought the whole sound system to Berlin to Wax Treatment and Mark Ernestos. And he every now and then unpacks it and plays it here in Berlin or in other places, and we brought it to Munich in the summer to have some improv on the sound system, which, as you might know, is all sound systems have a lot of bass, and they are actually extremely powerful and never hurtful to your ears, as loud as they might be. And so it was a kind of a pretty fantastic physical and also cerebral experience to have that. And then before that, we had Moritz von Oswald and his trio together with Tony Allen, the fantastic Fela Kuti drummer, playing a great set. And just a couple of weeks ago in October, we did something to commemorate the new music festival in Darmstadt, and we performed some Stockhausen Cyclists that has it's a percussion piece that has quite a bit of improvisation in it. We also had a fantastic contemporary composer and improviser, Michael Wertmüller, who played a great piece of solo drumming. And we finished the evening off with Steve Reich's tape recording called Come Out that he made in commemoration of the Harlem Six that were persecuted in 1966 for a murder that they had nothing to do with. It's a tape loop based on sentences that were recorded while these Harlem Six were interviewed by police, like in 1966. And the next event is coming up soon, 19th of November. We'll have, and I'm very, very much looking forward to that, we will have the first presentation of the Oxford Handbook of Critical Improvisational Studies. That's edited by George Lewis, a trombone player, composer, and professor at Columbia University, together with Benjamin Picot, who is a professor at Cornell. And we decided on a program that will include a couple of the contributors to the book, Georgina Born among them. She's professor for music and anthropology at Oxford and a professorial fellow at Mansfield College. She's also a great musician. She played with Henry Cow, the Odd Beers, Michael Nyman's band. She's a member of the London Musicians Collective, and on and on and on. She's really one of the great people thinking and working in music today. We also have Sarah Villa, who will speak about improvisatory practices at the dawn of the new American cinema. Christopher Dell from Berlin about improvisation technology as mode of redesigning the urban. We will have Harald Kisiedo, who will talk about jazz experimentalism in East Germany and the GDR. And we have Ray MacDonald, who is professor for music psychology and improvisation in Edinburgh. And his contribution has a great title. It's Billy Connolly, Daniel Barenboim, Willy Wonka, Jazz Bastards, and the Universality of Improvisation. So it's going to be an afternoon and evening about improvisation and how it's unfolding in different fields of practice. And that will all lead to an exhibition that's going to open at Haus der Kunst in March 2017. That exhibition is called The Living Music. It's about the Berlin label and platform FMP, Free Music Production, that existed from 1968 to 2012 and really made a couple of quite amazing contributions to the field of improvised music. So I'm head over heels in that project, working both on the events leading to it and working on the catalog and, of course, you know, working on the loans and the material that's going to get into that exhibition. Yeah.
So that sounds fantastic and also kind of a huge project, but incredibly exciting. You said these events lead to it. Are these events, what I would like to talk about is how they lead to it. Are they in the actual gallery spaces? And beyond that, I'd like to know when it actually opens next year, what will be shown? Is there visual work that comes with all of this? Is it documentation? So two questions. How do these events lead up into the show? And the second question is, what will the show visually look like? I mean, I guess you don't know now, but just roughly how visitor experience.
I hope I do know it roughly, because time's of an essence here. It's around the corner. So the Haus der Kunst has a designated space for concerts and discussions. It's the so-called West Wing. Haus der Kunst is a pretty big building. And just to give you briefly the history, it was built by the Nazis to house German art, what they understood to be the real art, in contrast to what they called the degenerate art. And it was opened in 1937. And was the headquarters of the American Army after the war. They renamed it into P1, and it serves as a museum and house of contemporary art since more than 25 years now. Okri Enveso is the director of the Haus der Kunst. And FMP and the whole series of events under the title of ECM follow up on the heels of an exhibition that Okri and I curated in 2012 that was also about a music label called ECM that's based in Munich. And and FMP is somehow the wild little brother of ECM. They're basically founded just 1 year apart. All the important contributors to both labels knew each other quite well. They also collaborated quite closely in the beginning. And ECM, of course, has become this major world label with the Cologne concert by Keith Jarrett, maybe the best known example of its work. And FMP has stayed in Berlin and has become, over decades, has become this stable and safe haven for specific artistic practice that they basically invented and brought to the fore. All of what they did was informed by the wish to give musicians possibilities to work in ways that they would have nowhere else but at FMP. Everything we do beforehand somehow tries to make people understand that we believe, or that I believe, that improvisation is really an extremely necessary, almost like evolutionary tool that is not just restricted to usage in, let's say, jazz, but that is a capability that you have to develop to basically to be successful in whatever you do. And so we look at improvisation in different kinds of musics and in different kinds of contexts. And the symposium that I just talked about with George will give us a wide scope of interesting entry points into that idea of improvisation being an essential part of our everyday life. Now, FMP, as I said, has been running for more than 40 years. And what we'll show is a lot of documentation. We will show their posters. They've done hundreds of events over the years in Berlin. They produced hundreds of records, hundreds of CDs. All of that will be there and will be seen and will be heard. At the beginning of FMP, two of the main characters, Peter Bretzmann and Alexander von Schlippenbach, they had two important affiliations. Bretzmann worked closely with the Fluxus Group. He was the personal assistant of Nam June Paik. And I'm saying that the things that he experienced through Paik were formative for what he did in his music later on. And Alexander von Schlippenbach, the other guy, was a trained classical composer and pianist. And he worked with, at least for my money, the most important new music composer in Germany at that time, Bernd Alois Zimmermann, who had composed a fantastic opera called The Soldiers that includes a jazz quintet, and Schlippenbach played on the premiere with his quintet. So you have these two poles, Schlippenbach at the forefront of new music and Bretzmann in the midst of Fluxus revolutionizing former West Germany. And they have, through the years, also worked constantly with visual artists. So some of that examples will be seen in the exhibition, Fluxus work, but also works by Albert Oehlen, the painter, or Penck, the painter, or Kippenberger, Günter Förg. They also cooperated with Jean-Michel Basquiat, and on and on and on. And we will, at the one point, tell a pretty chronological story about what happened, where, and when. And then, of course, we will also have, quite a few treasures for people who are specifically interested in the label. I mean, just the fact that we will exhibit the complete output is something that I think has never happened, I think nobody ever thought of trying to gather all of that material. And we're very lucky because we have the full support of the guy who basically ran the ship for most of the time, Joost Gebers. And so, it's going to be an immersive exhibition that will feature a lot of what we call flatware, so stuff on the walls, but it will also have a lot of music, it will have quite a bit of art, and loads to read, and obviously we will also have weekends with musical contributions that will accompany that exhibition.
Well, that sounds pretty thrilling. I wish I was there to see it. And so the label you also mentioned that still exists, and the music can still be bought from them. Is that correct?
That's correct. And FMP also has had quite a radical reevaluation in the last couple of years. There were a lot of reissues by other labels who really wanted to bring back vinyl and bring back music from their shelves and from their archives. Most well known, at least over here in Europe, is the so-called Unheard Music series. That was done by the Chicago label, and of course the name escapes me right now, but being in my office might give me the opportunity to just look at my stash of FMP CDs. It's Atavistic, of course, Atavistic Records in Chicago, and there are other labels in Japan, in Austria, that are re-releasing FMPs on vinyl, and actually very successful, in some cases way more successful than when the stuff was originally published. Yeah, but it's still going.
That's exciting to hear. So from all these reissues of vinyl, which I see more and more all over the world, different companies, I guess, licensing it to reissue deluxe packages and beautiful packages, which which seem to be popular, is also a great way of that label having a rebirth. Not that it needs a rebirth, but that there's it extends into yet another generation that's collecting vinyl in new ways.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's I look at it admiringly, but at the same time, it's also kind of funny because the economic realities of the reissues sometimes do not really reflect how it was like in the not so good old days, because the reissues, they look much better, they sound much better. I mean, they are of course authentic reproductions, but the paper that's used today is just much better than the one that was used in, let's say, 1969, where they really had to scratch the money together to get the release out, and where, of course, producing records was a little bit like deciding, I mean, as a musician, to self-produce your records was a little bit like deciding to go and build your own car. You couldn't simply do it just like that. I mean, there was no immediate access to the industry. You basically had to invent it all and had to find in ways to surpass the usual canals that the major labels were using. So, yeah, it's quite exciting that this has suddenly become such a possibility. I mean, it started with the CD. And everybody obviously can produce their own CDs, and now we have this branching out into vinyl, and this is a little bit like a microbrewery syndrome, I would say.
Right. Yeah, it's very interesting, and that sounds like a really dynamic exhibition and fun to be part of. Thrilling, really. I'm so glad you shared that with us. There's one last project I wanted to talk to you about, which is about a small house, right? That was the last of a village. If you could describe that a little bit and your involvement in it.
Yeah, I do a lot of things. Hopefully not too much, but this is it's a very exciting project. It's a house. It's actually not that small. It's a pretty big house and a pretty big park. I don't really know how to translate it into acres, but it's huge. And it's the last house standing of a not so small village that was all taken away, dug away, by what we call in Germany surface mining. And so it's all gone, and then now there's a gigantic field there that was actually used by the Pope to give a prayer to the combined Catholic youth organizations a couple of years ago. But this soul house is now been turned into what Germans call a Kunsthalle, meaning an exhibition space that will show international works by up-and-coming artists, and this will be curated by Veit Lörs. And the house has an absolutely fascinating history. It was the core was built in 18th century, then it transformed quite a bit. It changed, of course, owners over the decades and the centuries. And one odd fun fact is that the German composer Karl Heinz Stockhausen was born there. And
this is a small house. Like I'm imagining of something small, but it must be larger than I'm thinking.
No. It was small, and then it grew. And in the 20th century, before Stockhausen was born there, it was actually turned into quite a mansion. I mean, I don't really know how to translate that into English, but think of, you know, plantation main house, Louisiana, something like that.
Wow.
So four stories, a gigantic park surrounding it, and this is right now in the process of being rebuilt. All the interior is taken out, and it will open in April next year. It's in this little village called Mödrath between Düsseldorf and Cologne and West Germany.
And what is your role there? What will you be? What are you doing?
It's a little bit like the Venice Pavilion, but more specifically, what I'm doing there is I'm advising the group that owns it and builds it up on how to solve very simple, specific questions of how to run an exhibition space in a place where there never was one. You know, how do you do that? What are your opening hours? Do you ask for admission or not? How many people do you need to run this show? But also to trying to advise them to how to create PR to get people there. Because, as I said, you know, this has not been used for cultural purposes for the longest time. It's a clean slate, and you know, you have to somehow inform people and bring people there and try to get people in so that they might enjoy what's going on there. So that's also part of my role in that specific context.
But the last village, when you initially talked about it, the last house in this village, I imagine it sort of looks almost destroyed around the house. But it sounds like it doesn't. There's a park and accessible. It's just that everything has been built up in other parts of the cities or torn down and built up. Is that the case?
That's a very good question. It's like, I mean, it's hard to describe if you have never seen surface mining. Now, just imagine, there was a village, people lived there. And let's say like 10 miles away, they started the surface mining. And the coal stretched out in the direction of the village. So what the surface mining does is they take away the coal, take away the soil, and they dig in the direction of the village. And as soon as the engineers know that the coal is where the village is, they start negotiation with the villagers. And they basically sell everybody out, and then they rip the whole village off to get to the coal. This happened quite a bit in Germany. But
this is all happening underground. We're talking about caverns underground. We're not seeing they're tearing down the houses because the houses are in danger. Is that correct?
No. Surface mining means you literally take a gigantic spoon and scratch the surface of the earth. It's not underground. You take away the surface. What we call the brown coal is right underneath the surface. So it's like you take a gigantic spoon, gigantic machinery, and you take off the top layer of the earth. So to get there, if the houses on there, you have to take the houses away. And then you spoon all of the earth where the house stood on, you spoon it away. So what happens then is the whole village is basically torn down, and then everything is taken off. And what in, like, let's say, pretty much 40 years ago, what you had there was a barren, moon-like landscape of dug-up earth with nothing on it, just heavy industrial machinery.
And you have this one house.
And this one singular house that basically was not touched because it was used as a house for women to deliver babies, and the neighborhood still needed that because of other villages around, and it was like the only facility of its kind at that time in the area. And in the following, I mean, the barren landscape, the moon-like landscape of 40 years ago was then carefully reconstructed in the coming decades, and now it's basically like a gigantic pasture. It's just a field of grass, and Karol Wojtyla was the pope who went there and did his mass to, I think, 1.5 million young people. And this is, again, we're talking about, this is just 150 meters away from the house.
Wow, and so potentially the village could be rebuilt there now.
No, because what you can do there is you can walk on that ground, but it's considered extremely unsafe. I mean, theoretically, yes, you can build there again, but then it would have to be some kind of Venice, Italy construction. You would have to pile drive into the ground to build stable foundations, because the huge hole that was created by digging the surface was filled with land, but that's not considered to be land that you could really build anything on. It's you can have a walk, you can ride a horse, and that's about it. But you don't want to build a house there.
Hmm.
And we're talking about a huge area. You know, this is like, you have to just think like Manhattan.
Wow. Wow, it's incredible. And so it's been great talking to you about these things. One question that I want to ask before we go is also how did you become, do you think, the person to go to advise people on projects as wide-ranging as the pavilion to this house? Because though there are similarities, they're also quite different.
They're quite different. That's the fun thing of my day-to-day work. I was lucky. I'm an art historian. I worked in a museum in Münster, Westphalia, in Germany, where, among other things, I had the great fortune of working on sculpture projects. That's an outdoor exhibition that happens every 10 years. It first started in 77, then 87, 97, 2007, and next year, 2017, will be its fifth inauguration. And I worked on the 97 exhibition, which was curated, as always, by Kaspar König, the German curator. And back then I met Oquien Visor, who asked me to join him for his Documenta 11 team. So I also worked on the Documenta in Kassel. And then I did a couple of other things. I also worked on the last Venice Biennale together with Oquien. I worked on a couple of German pavilions in Venice. And I work with a couple of international museums, advising them, and that's how this whole practice did come about. And then I also curate, but very rarely. I always say that I don't have that many good ideas. So if I curate, I do a lot that has to do with crossover, with music and visual arts. So the last major exhibition I did was in the Kunstmuseum in Stuttgart. It was called I Got Rhythm: Jazz and Visual Arts from 1920 to Today. And it was a historical survey about visual artists that were inspired by jazz, and we showed the history of that interrelationship, and how jazz started out as the avant la lettre pop music, basically, and then after the Second World War also became a synonym or a carrier for certain ideas of the independence and struggle in America and elsewhere. And yeah, those were phenomena that we showed and thematized in that Stuttgart exhibition, I Got Rhythm. That's...
I love the title of that, of course, and, you know, drawn from that era. Marcus, it's great talking to you about this. Before we go, I wanted to ask you if there's a book or two you're reading now that you want to share with me.
Absolutely. One thing I'm reading right now is from is from John Corbett. He's a Chicago music critic and gallerist, actually. He's one of my favorite writers about contemporary music. It's called Micro Groove, and it's a collection of his essays. Has really, really amazing stuff in it. It's something that I need to cherish every once in a while. People who can really write specifically well about music and its contexts. It also has a piece about George Lewis. So it's a bit also in preparation of my symposium in Haus der Kunst. And the other book is something quite fascinating. I'm not sure if I pronounce the author correctly. Cixin Liu. That's Cixin Liu. The Chinese author of a trilogy of what I would call science fiction novels. And I'm in the third one right now, Death's End. It's a fascinating combination of space war and space science, and it's quite an interesting read. I actually don't know who recommended it to me. Maybe Hans-Ulrich Obrist, because it's not usually down my alley, but it's really a fascinating trilogy of books. Yeah. So these are the two that are next to my bedside table right now.
Marcus, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been very enjoyable and fascinating.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.